be able to place a contact on the leaf of a tree or plant and then another contact at the roots, thereby perfecting a circuit. Then we run the circuit through a MIDI system, a computerized MIDI system. And this then converts what we take or what the tree gives us. And what it gives us is static electricity, or similar to static electricity. There are little bursts of electricity going on inside all living things, even a blade of grass. You can actually detect this. And so these little bursts, of course, are then, through the MIDI system, converted into musical notes, which therefore is just not raw static. It becomes something which we as humans can listen to and enjoy. It's melodic, as you say, to what you heard that time, Tim. And also there's a flow. The music changes from morning to night on the same plant. Also, the same plant will produce slightly different songs at the time of the year, summer or winter, autumn and spring. So this is an amazing, amazing tool to allow a deeper connection with plants. And also, because it's producing what we all term music or songs, these devices, and there are two or three others I'll mention later on the market as such, if you'd like to look at it that way, these are being uptaken by musicians around the world.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. We humans are all part of the web of life. We are all connected within the life support system we call the biosphere that envelops our marvelous planet, all encased in an invisible gaseous membrane we call our atmosphere. Whilst down on the Earth's surface, life predominates, where numerous invisible cycles within cycles prevail. One of the most profound of these is the carbon cycle, what others may call the oxygen cycle, where humans and animals breathe out carbon dioxide and the plant kingdom and plankton in the oceans take the CO2 in and through photosynthesis releases oxygen or O2 back into the atmosphere for us to continue breathing. This is just one invisible example of a homeostatic relationship between humans and all animals and the plant and tree kingdom, that we actually support each other for our very needs. This is magic, and our planet has worked this out prior to humans emerging onto our planet's surface. On the phone from Kati Kati in the Bay of Plenty, I have Gary Cook. Gary is an author, he is an explorer, and he has looked at the distant past of New Zealand. He is also immersed among nature, and he has a very, very important story to tell about his relationship with trees. So, kia ora, Gary, lovely to hear your voice, and I'm so glad that you can be with me today.
Oh, kia ora there, Tim. It's so nice to hear you again also. And yes, I'm sitting down here in brilliant sunlight today. I'm inside, of course, looking out the window. Beautiful day, and it's just lovely to be able to sit down quietly here and have a chat with you and hopefully share with you some things which your listeners will find very interesting and actually very important.
Thank you. Yes, I've interviewed you before, Gary, in relationship to the distant past of New Zealand, and we will come to that in another interview. But recently, or 18 months ago, I happened to be at your place with a whole tour group from the United States and a few Europeans as well, and you took me down to the riverside where you had many, many trees, but you had some wired up to a sound system, and the sound was crystalline music. It was nearly like a soothing symphony that bathed you. Can you share with us all about this fantastic breakthrough that you are involved in?
Right, it is fascinating, Tim, and it is actually leading me down all sorts of different paths in the world of plants and trees and forests. And as to what you heard that time you were here, it is something that I have now been experimenting with and doing lots of work with a device. The first device I got was called Music of the Plants, that's the name of it, and it was perfected by technicians who live in the Damanhur collective of villages in northern Italy. And what they have produced with the, what they call the IU device, is a culmination of 40 to 50 years of work, which goes right back to the days of Clive Baxter, when he was looking at using biofeedback, hookups with plants, etc., as well as lie detection equipment. So this has evolved over a long period of time, and this device is sensitive enough to be able to place a contact on the leaf of a tree or plant, and then another contact at the roots, thereby perfecting a circuit. Then we run the circuit through a MIDI system, a computerized MIDI system. And this then converts what we take, or what the tree gives us. And what it gives us is static electricity, or similar to static electricity. There are little bursts of electricity going on inside all living things, even a blade of grass. You can actually detect this. And so these little bursts, of course, are then, through the MIDI system, converted into musical notes, which therefore is just not raw static. It becomes something which we as humans can listen to and enjoy. It's melodic, as you say, to what you heard that time, Tim. And also there's a flow. The music changes from morning to night on the same plant. Also, the same plant will produce slightly different songs the time of the year, summer or winter, autumn and spring. So this is an amazing, amazing tool to allow a deeper connection with plants. And also, because it's producing what we all term music or songs, these devices, and there are two or three others I'll mention later on the market as such, if you'd like to look at it that way, these are being uptaken by musicians around the world, solo musicians, singers, even jazz groups and small orchestras put together to play with plants. And performances are being carried out at various venues and stages right around the world. And so this is a very enlightening way of bringing people into contact with the deeper, more important aspect of the plant world.
It's a very, very fascinating time for the human race now to realize the connectivity to our planet as a superorganism, and realize that all these trees that surround us and cycle through our CO2 and give us back oxygen are here for something that we have yet to understand. And you and I, when we go into a forest, if we only had the sensitivities, we would hear all these different trees as if they were part of an orchestra that was playing something that yet we have to actually hear. So
that's right, Tim. This is so exciting. But the thing is that there's research being done, as I said, into the plant world and looking at plant consciousness and looking at plant awareness. And there is a term which has come about, and it's called plant blindness. Plant blindness actually is summed up very, very nicely here. I'll just quote this here from a report. Plant blindness is the inability to see or notice the plants in one's own environment, which leads to A, the inability to recognize the importance of plants in the biosphere and in human affairs, B, the inability to appreciate the aesthetic and unique biological features of the plant life forms, all belonging to the plant kingdom, and C, the misguided ranking of plants as inferior to animals, leading to the erroneous conclusion that they are unworthy of human consideration. I find this wonderful, wonderful summation by Wanderse and Schuessler, published in a paper back in 1998. So here we have now scientists sort of standing up, stepping out with their research and publishing papers and giving lectures on plant consciousness, to the point, Tim, where a lot of them are now saying that within 15 to 20 years' time, we, the human race, are going to have to recognize trees as sentient beings. Now, that yes. is a big stretch. And as you remember, a few years ago, New Zealand was the first signatory in the world to sign a declaration protecting mammals and giving them the ranking of being sentient beings who protect them from cruelty and misuse and things like that. So we have got some pretty big stepping stones ahead of us.
We certainly have, with Tūhoe in their particular region, Te Yorawera, north of Waikaremoana. A park has been given human rights, and also with the Whanganui River, it's now been seen by the New Zealand government, well, they've called it that way, that it is a living entity. So there's a greater understanding of the wholeness of nature, and that's all, as you say, connected within the biosphere. So this is wonderful stuff, particularly in acknowledging Mother Earth and Papatūānuku.
Oh, this is right. And I find, Tim, that the work that I'm doing with music of the plants, if we want to call it that, or plant songs, is the fact that it is an eye-opener. It's a door-opener for a lot of people because it takes them into another realm. And often when I'm demonstrating to people, there are people sitting with me who are very, very sensitive to nature and to the trees around us and the plants and what have you. And there are others who have just take trees as being nice little things which appear in the background and they're green and we might talk to one as we walk past, but often we just don't notice the trees as much as we notice other life. So, I mean, for instance, in Japan, back in the 80s, the Japanese government actually passed a law to enable or to actually push Japanese people in the pursuit of Shinrin Yoku, which is a term where you use trees and nature to heal oneself. And that's what they do. It's called Japanese forest medicine. And when the Japanese government introduced the concept of Shinrin Yoku, or forest bathing, it urged people to make use of the country's generous wooded areas for therapy. Now, that was an amazing stepping stone. This now is spreading into the Western world. And once again, we often find that parts of Europe and, of course, parts of the US of A, people become very interested in these things. And so they are gaining traction and gaining momentum. And to call it forest bathing, people just think, well, you know, sort of, okay, do I have to go and sort of find a little pool to bathe in the forest? No. The translation just means that you are bathing yourself, your being, in the trees and how the trees will help you to find health and happiness. It's as simple as that. And as you and I know, Tim, the times that we have the opportunity to walk in a forest, whether we're with a group or on our own, it is just magical. We feel good. We feel better. It's, you know, it's uplifting. It's healing. It's invigorating.
I can agree with you very much so. I call it an aura cleanse. So as we walk through the different fern fronds and the different leafy branches, wipe our energy field of all stuff that we may have been carrying for the last so many days, years, or whatever. And it is, as you say, it's a wonderful word to be able to say, go for a forest bathe. I'll remember that.
I love that term, Tim. And they sort of put out a few things. So when you go into the forest, leave phone behind, the camera behind, music, any other distractions behind. And also the big thing, as you would know, is leave behind expectations. And you just slow down and you forget about time and bring yourself into the present moment where you are. Find a spot to sit on the grass beside a tree or even if you're in a park on a seat. And then notice what you hear and see and notice what you feel. And they say there, if possible, stay for 2 hours. And through this, you will notice effects even after 20 minutes. So forest bathing is available to everyone. We can do it at any time.
Very good. Because the Japanese, they have an understanding of Zen as an extension of their Buddhist ways of understanding the world. And being in Zen is a very clear-minded state of being. And so we need to just be aware of that, be in the moment, be very present, and that's it. That's it. So,
you're telling me. you know, not only that, that's the opportunity which is given to us by walking in the forest, but also if we approach a tree in the garden, in the park, or in a forest, and we stand beside the trunk of the tree, whether we have our hands on it or not, and as we breathe in, we're breathing in the oxygen that that tree is putting forth. And as we breathe out, we're breathing out CO2 that that tree is breathing in. So we have this incredible symbiotic relationship, which a lot of people don't look at it like this. Without the trees breathing, we in the human form would not exist. We wouldn't be breathing the way that we do. We wouldn't be the carbon beings that we are. So I think it's rather wonderful, just a simple thing is just to stand by a tree, become aware of your natural rhythm of your breathing in and out, and just be aware, if you have your hands on the trunk, that this tree is breathing in and out in line with you. So what an incredible relationship we have.
It certainly is. And Gary, I've mentioned this a few times to a few people, but I need to be able to share it again, specifically with you. And in 1977, I went to Findhorn in Scotland, and Findhorn is known as a community where the people who live in this community have a ongoing relationship with the nature kingdom, and that during meditation, they can actually hear or have trees and plants communicate with them to say, we are a sycamore tree. We like to be in such and such conditions. We like to be either in a warm, sunny outlook, or another tree may want to be in a more damper situation, away from the wind, etc. And so the Findhornians were able to glean so much knowledge from these trees, and so they planted these trees in the community to benefit them all, as you say, as a wonderful symbiotic relationship. So just prior to going to Findhorn, I was with a friend here in New Zealand, and she was a very, very adept person when it came to healing, and she was able to see deeply into nature. And she said, Tim, come with me, and we'll go to Mossy Glade. I want you to put your arms around a tree here. And so she pointed out to this pine tree, and it wasn't very big at all, and she said, go and put your arms around it. And so I thought, okay, here, tree hugging. So I went and I put my arms around that tree. And in that moment, whoosh, my whole being sort of became white light, and I shot up the tree, out through the limbs, up through the branches, out through the pine needles. And then all around me for about, I don't know, 2.5 meters, I felt this incredible surge of all the roots in the ground go up through my being and continue up through the tree. And in that moment, I realized I'd become one of this tree. This is, you know, so profound. And I also realized that every First Nation Indigenous person to North America could do this. That the fact is that this ability is open to all human beings. And the thing that I learned the most, it wasn't me who was doing it. It was some sort of timing thing or an outside force that allowed me to experience this magic.
Wow, Tim, what an incredible event that you were party to. It's interesting, too, when at Findhorn they talk about the trees communicating and being able to communicate with humans. This is wonderful. And I feel that this is what is happening now. This is a great doorway with the music of the plants or listening to plant music devices. But it's interesting, too, that within the forest, trees can talk and see and recognize their offspring. It's not well known, but, well, among people who are interested in plants and trees and that, the trees in a given forest, regardless of species, are all connected to each other by what they call the mycelium, which is a fungus which grows under the surface of the forest floor or even in your own gardens. It's an incredibly fine network of fungal fibers, finer and then the hair on your head, and they connect tree to tree, plant to plant. Now, this is a symbiotic relationship. The mycelium, of course, feed on plant sugars, and as we know, when the tree brings down the carbon from the atmosphere, it converts it into plant sugars, which feeds the tree. The tree also needs minerals for its growth and also needs water. Now, the mycelium feeds on the plant sugar, but the mycelium also helps to guide the tree. The tree may be lacking in water or some particular minerals. The mycelium, by touching the roots of the tree, will guide the tree roots, the small filaments on the end of a tree root, towards another source of nourishment or water. But also, the mycelium connects all the trees together. I always understood, Tim, that there were connections in the forest amongst trees.
Yes.
And I thought, well, look up at the canopy, branches perhaps touch. Under the ground, we're aware that roots may come close to each other. But I've only learnt in recent years it's the mycelium which connects them all together. And to the point that the mycelium is a conveyor of nourishment and also a conveyor of use of nourishment, will also take plant sugars from a mother tree,
yes,
to seedlings of the same or even a different species that are not doing well, and take plant sugars and feed these little seedlings to nurture them until such time as, of course, they can find the way to grow to full maturity. Now, the mycelium, of course, which we don't really realize, is it's a fungus. And the only time that we really see this is when it flowers above the ground in the form of mushrooms and toadstools. And all the fungi we see in the forest around the gardens and damp places, that is the flowering head of mycelium. So in your garden and when you're walking in the forest, Tim, just under the surface, you're walking in what people are now calling the wood wide web.
Correct.
Where information travels right through the forest from tree to tree and species to species. Isn't that incredible? Trees are living, Tim, as a community.
This is correct. This is mycologist Paul Stamets has done a lot of what you call underground work in allowing us to see that how all the fungi work and how this magic is there, but for some unknown reason, with the bulldozer type attitude that has come in with sort of the pioneers coming in and today, present day, what would you call them, developers, we're not taking a deep breath before we actually go out and put our dwelling in. And this is where I maintain that all developers have to have a marine biology degree, preferably a PhD in marine biology, because at the water's edge and then into the land just next door, this is where most New Zealanders are very much wanting to embed their home. So we have to have a new consciousness to realize that if we're going to live among nature, there are all these critters, you know, from ants and earthworms and every other small insect that's part of a greater canopy of trees and plants. It's a case of awakening to how we live bioharmonically within nature.
You're quite right, Tim, and this comes back, I guess, a little to what I mentioned earlier on, plant blindness, because for a lot of people there, a tree might be a nice little backdrop in their garden or on the side of the road as you walk down to the bus stop every day, but they're more likely to acknowledge people or cats and dogs and things like this as they walk down the road without bothering too much about the trees. And also a lot of people, of course, just see forest trees as things which to be felled and to be utilized for human purposes such as shelter and warmth and things of this nature. And also, of course, the trees that provide us with the fruits and nuts that we need as humans. And then, of course, there is the other aspect of plant blindness where a tree growing sort of, as you say, you know, sort of on a reserve area which is close to the seashore and someone comes and builds a house and suddenly finds that that tree next door is blocking the incredible view which they paid thousands of dollars for, and they go and chop the bloody tree down.
Yeah.
My French. Chop the tree down.
Or
rebark because it's in the way.
Yes.
There's no thought given to that tree. It's interesting. And Tim, as you know, looking back in Aotearoa, the Māori, when they would go into the forest to take a tree for carving, a tautra tree, rimu, or even a kauri, the selection of the tree was quite something which was done with the appropriate karakia and also the tohunga selecting the tree to be felled. There are all sorts of ways that the Tohunga read the availability of the tree, the fact that it was ready. Now, one thing I loved about what they did in the old days, some people may still be doing it today, when they took a tree of this nature and the stump was there in the forest, they would hollow out the center of the stump, fill it with the loam and the soil from the forest, and then put a seedling of the same species into that stump to regrow. And I thought, this is what we should be looking at. I think our attitude towards trees is a pine forest. They're introduced species, Pinus radiata, let's chop the hell out of them and ship them off and make lots of money out of them. And, you know, Tim, I've even thought, and I might put this in here, and you may find it interesting, that a couple of years ago I was looking at statistics with forestry accidents where people, working mostly in pine forests, and accidents do occur. And I just wonder if the forestry gangs, and there's a lot of young and older Māori men work in these forestry gangs, so I'm wondering if there's ever anyone there every morning to lead a karakia before they even go and cut down the lowly pine tree. It is a living entity after all. Because I sometimes wonder whether the tree in the forest, when it falls the wrong way and nudges someone heavily or softly and injures them, I wonder if they could have taken precautions, perhaps, and do they speak to each tree before they fell it? Do they tell the tree why they're chopping it down? And that's something I know that on a smaller scale and sort of in your own land, a lot of people do.
You must have been reading my mind, because where I work at the holiday park, there was a forester staying there for a couple of weeks, and he was Māori, he was about 30, and I asked him, I said, well, look, when you drive up to the forest and you know you're going to be cutting down maybe 70, 150, I don't know how many trees, do you say a karakia for each tree? And he said, no, I don't. He says, when I drive up, I say a blanket karakia for all the trees that I'm going to cut down. And I thought, wow, bro, that's fantastic. Good for you. So, yes, it's embedded in them. I'm finding that I can talk to virtually all Māori that I meet, and the first thing I'll say is Papatūānuku, Mother Earth, and they will start to sing the virtues of nature right from there, Gary. They're intuitively plugged in.
How wonderful, because this just may help, you know, to sort of balance life out in a far more proportionate manner, also perhaps to protect some of them from possible injury.
Yes, well, we have to be open to the finer nuances of existence, Gary, because I know, can I just throw this way back? I remember I came into this in the sort of early 1970s, and particularly in the mid-1970s, Lyle Watson produced a book called Supernature, and then Peter Tompkins and Christopher Bird brought out The Secret Life of Plants to later...
That's right.
And to later then bring out the secrets of the soil. And it was a very fertile ground in the late 60s into the 70s, where there was a lot of, I'd say, awakening here in New Zealand. There was the teachings of Don Juan, Carlos Castaneda, and the Yaqui way of knowledge. People had heard of Findhorn. The autobiography of a yogi was moving around, and as you know, that Yogananda covered a whole lot of different people that he met who were involved in nature and who were realizing that we were an extension of something greater that was living and very, very profound. And so we are in a situation now where we need another expansive in-breath so that we can really grok or really intuit the greater picture of our great sustainer, Mother Earth, that has lent us bodies, lends us free air, free rainwater, and until recently a free food chain. So connection is everything, isn't it?
Oh, look, it certainly is. I mean, I just read an article a while ago, you talk about connection, and this is a connection between people who garden, get out in the soil, growing the vegetables, or tending the forest as foresters and whatever they're doing. And researchers are discovering the ways that we trigger a natural production of happy chemicals that keep depression at bay with surprising results. So what they're saying, gardeners don't need to take antidepressants. All you need to do, get your fingers dirty and harvest your own food, because they've come across the fact that getting your hands dirty in the garden can increase your serotonin levels, but contact with soil and a specific soil bacteria, Mycobacterium vaccae, triggers the release of serotonin in our brain, according to research. And serotonin is a happy chemical, a natural antidepressant, and strengthens the immune system. Isn't that interesting? So once again, the mother, Papatūānuku, just being with her, and as gardeners, and this is what Mike O'Donnell has always said, we are not only gardeners of the soil, but we are gardeners of the soul as well. So these are all good pointers.
Very true. There's a number of things I want to cover now. Yesterday I went with a group of 180 adults and a lot of children, and we planted 5,125 trees up at Tarawhānui in the park up there. And
wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
And so this is the so-called in-breath that you get when you're with all these volunteers and we're all digging holes and we're putting these plants in and we're all sharing and we come away euphoric. And so, yes, all this is part and parcel of our connection with the land. And when you just mentioned Mike O'Donnell, whom I've interviewed, lovely, lovely brother, and he once took me down to his little creek at the back of his property, and he showed me these luminescent limpets. And what it meant was he went down to the water's edge in his little creek, and he got in, and he slowly walked around, and all of a sudden I could see all these lights. It was like looking into starlight in the sky on a clear night, and they were all in the water around his feet. And I'd never seen this before. And I was shocked to realize that, in actual fact, coming out of the Coromandel Ranges, which move on to become the Kaimai Ranges, which then go on to Rotorua as the Mamaku. But this is something that's in nature that we never even knew about it. But I have seen glowworms hanging from the banks at your property down in Katikati.
That's right. Oh, look, it's so fascinating here, Tim. Things that we have never seen or don't know of. And it's wonderful that we can actually share these stories here too. But I just had another little... I'm going to toss this in here. It's nothing to do with glowworms and little limpets. A scientific article I just read recently, and the scientists have now discovered trees have a heartbeat, which is interesting. And they've discovered that trunks and the branches of trees are actually contracting and expanding to pump water up from the roots to the leaves, similar to the ways the human heart and mammal hearts pump blood through its bodies. So the only difference between human pulse and a tree is a tree's much slower beating, once every 2 hours or so. So instead of regulating blood pressure, the heartbeat of a tree regulates water pressure. Isn't that intriguing?
I'm speaking with Gary Cook, author, a researcher of many subjects, and his website is secretland.co.nz. Secretland.co.nz.
There's a lot of similarities, and also another paper I looked at recently, published in the Nature Journal. Two scientists have now stated that trees can see. Trees can make out shape and make out colour. And I thought, wow, what's going on here? So they were investigating how the tree goes through the process of photosynthesis, where through the leaves it takes in the sunlight and also absorbs the carbons out of the air. They discovered in looking at the leaves, the branches, the twigs, and the trunks, that the whole of the exterior surface of a tree is covered in millions and millions of tiny cells. And by looking closely at these cells, the shape of them is exactly the same as the human retina.
Ooh, gee.
Unfortunately smaller. They are now saying that, and they're setting out to prove, that trees can make out indistinct shapes moving, and trees can also differentiate between colour. Isn't that fascinating?
This is wild. This is really, really
wild.
It's
wild. It's wild. And did you know, Tim, that also the trees do go to sleep at night. It's something which is hard to observe. But they have done this with infrared and time-lapse cameras, just looking at forest trees and trees in the garden. And during the course of the night, when the sun sets, dusk comes, slowly, slowly, imperceptibly to the human eye, the branches all start to droop down. They go into a repose, and they go quite a few centimeters down. And then prior to the dawn, prior to sunrise, the branches all rise again. And, I mean, we've seen this, haven't we, Tim, with sunflowers and other flowers in the garden, which turn the sun during the day. So this is wonderful. And also something which I find very, very interesting as far as we're concerned in this land with our birds. I mean, we treasure our songbirds, our natural songbirds. We also treasure the introduced songbirds, such as the thrush and others, which have a beautiful song. Now, they have said, scientists, they have said that the dawn chorus prior to the rising of the sun is so important to all the trees and plants that grow in the forest. So with the resonance of the bird song, there is a further enlivening of the tree, telling them that the light is coming, time to move yourself up, get yourself ready to start absorbing the light and the sunlight, bringing in the carbons and doing what you do. Isn't that intriguing?
It's fantastic, because from what I can gather, the earthworms start to move as well. There's a whole...
Do they?
Yes, there's a whole orchestration going on underneath the surface, and this is where the birds can come out, and you'll watch a thrasher or blackbird, and they'll tilt their head slightly to a side, and they'll listen, and then they'll take a couple of hops, and then they'll look down, and then bang, they'll get their beak and then pull that worm out of it. Look, it's wonderful. And I remember I was at your place some years ago, and I'm throwing this in, hope you don't mind, and we're down by the river that night, and we had a fire. And we were sitting around, a group of us, and we were talking,
telling stories.
And then one person stood up, and he was a First Nation from the United States of America. He was an, what we would call an American Indian, but who happened to be also, I think, a retired general from the U.S. Army. He stood up, and he went over and got a branch that was dry. He walked over to the fire that was in need of some more firewood, and as he bent over and put the branch in the fire, he said, "To all my relations." And I was shocked. I realized then that he had an intimate relationship with all the trees, and this one had been an old branch that had fallen, and he was putting light, putting this piece of a branch into the fire to give us light and warmth, and like a karakia, like a prayer, he was acknowledging that it was part of his greater kin, for want of a better word, all my relations. Fascinating.
Oh, Tim, that is. Yes, I remember that gathering that time, and Cherokee Indian man, John Wolfe. Yes, interesting. Now, so what I'm finding with all of this and the scientific research, I'm culling, you know, the internet and following up papers being published and things like this. And I'm discovering, Tim, that the more I do plant music with the same trees or the same plant, the same pot plant, the deeper my relationship becomes with an individual tree or an individual plant.
Yes.
Now, for almost 5 years, I've been playing music in the house, or when I go out and give public talks, with a peace lily, Sabella, our peace lily. We have an incredible relationship, and she will respond to me.
Yes.
I can sing to her, or I can keep quiet and play Brahms music to her and listen to her song change as she listens to Brahms being played. I can stroke her leaves or just direct thought to her, and her song will change in an acknowledgement. Likewise, outside on the edge of the forest here, one of many, many little kawakawa trees, and this beautiful kawakawa, I know, and I take visitors to demonstrate, walk up to her and put the little apparatus on the leaves and on the roots, she'll burst into song straight away. So we can, you know, sort of have a bit of a personal relationship. And you and I know, we've both spoken with trees over a period of time, and also a lot of other people have their favourite plants, either in the garden or if they don't have a garden living in an urban area, they've got pot plants they tend lovingly on the veranda or on the balcony or inside, and a lot of people have conversations with them. And the plants are hearing them. The plants know. They can pick up, I think, on our emotions. And as you were saying before, it's almost like an etheric thing. They can pick up on our auras. So there's a lot going on out there, isn't there, Tim?
Very much so. And particular, and I want to bring this in, because when you have a 2,000-year-old kauri tree standing in this one place, and our planet is turning around, the stars are going across in the sky, and humans come and go, this great being, this profoundly venerated being, needs, in many ways, more loving care. Or what I'm trying to find is that if you lie down underneath a kauri tree and spend the night under a kauri tree and just look up the trunk, up into the branches, and watch the stars move slowly behind these branches or above these branches, we see that there's this being that's been there, and humans have come and gone, and it's still there. And the necessity, one, for us to really revere them, and the other thing is that we've got a disease that's affecting us too, and we have to find a way in which to take care of New Zealand's grandest being. Any ideas on this?
Not so much on a direct approach to countering the kauri dieback virus, but a way that people can still communicate with their dear kauri trees, whether it's Tane Mahutu or other trees that they like. The directions going out now from the scientists are keep away from the trees. Don't walk around them. Don't walk around the base of them, because the virus is carried on the soles of our shoes and also in the cloven hooves of wild pigs. So they say it's distributed in this manner. Now, there is one other tree in the forest, and this is the forest communicator, and it is the Tanikaha.
Okay.
And I say to people, no matter where you are, even if you are in one of the kauri forests up north, and you want to send a particular message to the kauri, and you can't get close to it, find the nearest Tanikaha. There you can stand with Tanikaha. You can lay underneath Tanikaha. You can put your hands on Tanikaha. And Tanikaha will convey your message and your feelings of well-being to the kauri tree, actually through every species in the surrounding forest. So don't forget, we have this interconnection under the ground with the mycelium. Scientists are saying it may be the mycelium also which is carrying the virus. This they don't know. But also, Tim, I had an orchardist come visit me a few months ago, and when he had his organic orchard, he was having to treat his organic avocados, which he couldn't do. There was a virus which had come into New Zealand and was affecting all the avocados and going to knock them dead. So they identified the virus and they had to inject every tree every day. He couldn't do this being an organic gardener. But this is the same virus which is affecting the kauri trees. It's identical. And it's been in the New Zealand soil for over 100 years. It was introduced. It's endemic in parts of Northern Europe and also in Asia. So there are ways of combating, and I know scientists are experimenting with injecting trees with the same chemicals that they injected into the avocado trees to try and spot big kauri trees, which are 200 to 300, 400 years old, which they're experimenting with. And they've been doing this now for 6 or 7 years. Still, it's early to say whether or not this is going to work. So that is my sort of advice to people. We can't go and hug the kauri like we used to, but we can certainly hug the Tanikaha and send the message through Tanikaha.
Well, you just... When I was born, my mother took me home to our little house in Te Poi, which is at Matamata, yep, underneath a kaimai. And the only native tree we had around our house was a Tanikaha. And Wow. So maybe the Tanikaha now is talking through me to be able to share with you and to share to the greater world our connection as a global family slowly coming together on this magnificent planet that is our great sustainer.
That's right, Tim.
Oh, fantastic. Gary, I'd like you to tell us just a little bit more about the music coming from the trees, because I remember there's a woman called Dorothy Retallick back in the late 1970s. She brought out a little book or pamphlet called The Sound of Music and Plants, which she put plants up or put plants in a room, and she played Ravi Shankar, which they liked, and they liked Bach, very much so, but they were turned off by Led Zeppelin too.
Oh, I wonder.
Yeah, well, A Whole Lot of Love, I think, is one of them, but it still didn't get the trees or the plants to expand their roots. And this is how she did it. She measured the root length of the plants, and the largest root mass naturally was from bark. So there's something else there as well, the vibe. It has to be a good vibe.
I think so, Tim, yeah. And there has been a lot of research done, as you're saying, for many, many years into how music can affect the growth of plants. And this is plants just in your home or even to commercially growing vegetable crops and things of this nature, corn and sunflowers, and playing the music, you know, sort of through speaker systems out in the fields. And it did bring dividends. So there's definitely something about the resonance of sound which the plants pick up on. But now, of course, we can also listen to the resonance of the sound that the plants are producing themselves. And it may be that through this and certain types of plants, the plants that we require for human food, we can actually start to tune things so we can provide better natural environments for food crops to grow in.
Very true. I mean, the fact is that I've chosen to eat plant life, and it's 40 years since I've eaten, say, red meat and poultry, and I'm wanting to see if I can get back to the stage where we have this affinity to the fact that, you know, the gigantic woodlands and forests and jungles and bush areas of our planet, I mean, they've been receding very fast as a result of unconscious logging and unconscious actions. And so I would dearly like to think that this worldwood web starts to become more abundant, and the fact that we can start growing things, just as I did yesterday, where lots of people came together. And I know in China in particular, and also in India, people are planting trees en masse. They're doing huge amounts to restore the family of plants and trees. And I thank you so much, Gary, for mentioning about this plant blindness, because these great trees, I mean, boy, the xylem and the phloem and the moisture or the water going up to the leaves, etc., and the movement of sugars and everything. Very complex. When you look at the veins of a leaf, and I just realized it the other day, some Zen Buddhists there don't want to walk on grass because you bend over the leaves of the grass, and of course the grass then has to find a way to rebuild that crink that you've caused in the vein of that leaf for the plant to actually replenish itself and grow again. So the sheer complexity, and thank God for the micro technology for us to be able to look deep down into nature to see what these microflora are doing, what the fungi and the bacteria are doing. And I just want to throw this in because I was with Elizabeth Sartoris. She's a geobiologist and a very profound woman out of America at Sartoris.com. And I once went to pick her up from the airport, And I asked her what she had been doing, and she said, oh, well, look, I've actually been with the Dalai Lama, and we've been staying in the Pope's summer cottage in Italy. And I thought, boy, that's pretty powerful. That the fact is that a geobiologist studying the planet as a living entity or a living being is associating with these people who have got the spiritual or religious understanding of how things are connected. Anyway, she mentioned that scientists are endeavouring to work this out, and they think they've got a handle on it. There was bacteria were the first microorganisms to move, to come into being.
Yep.
And some of them had a pseudopodium. They sort of worked like protoplasm or moved by their protoplasmic ways. Not too sure how to put this. But one of these bacteria, way back, decided to stay in one place, put out what you call a chlorophyll connector or a photovoltaic cell that took in sunlight, and then they put down roots, and that became the tree. And the other bacterium decided to go around and ingest their food and possibly other bacteria. And so that is where the animal kingdom came, with the movement of these bacteria, and the vegetable kingdom came as a result of putting down roots and taking sunlight. And I think that's where they find the fork in the road and how life came into being.
Oh, this is so right. It's, yeah, it makes so much sense in a scientific way and also in a spiritual way. And you're saying before, Tim, that you know, the Buddhists say that when you walk on the grass is never the same again. Likewise, when you walk on the grass, and even not under your footsteps, when your shadow falls on the grass as you walk, that grass, the awareness of that grass has changed forever.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Perceptions change, yeah.
Mm. So because light and darkness is a major contributing factor.
That's right. Suddenly in the middle of the day, something walks past and casts a shadow on the grass and it affects it. Yeah. Fascinating.
The sensitivity is profound, really, isn't it, Gary?
It is.
Yes. And can I ask, when you bathe yourself in your music, when you put your electrodes, not electrodes, what are they? What you actually connect to the tree?
They're just connectors. They're sensitive wire connectors. Okay, they might have little gel pads on, depending on what surface I'm doing this on. So we do make a good positive connection with the surface of the leaf or the surface of the branch or trunk.
Okay, yes. Well, the consciousness of a human race at the moment is having the ability to be able to expand into the finer and the more hidden qualities of life. It was like Nikola Tesla said that humankind will evolve more in one decade than they will in all of history when they finally start researching and studying the invisible. And this is what's happening now.
It is, and yet it will no longer remain the invisible, which
yes.
I love.
Yes, very true. As our cameras get more, shall we say, finely tuned. I remember that with Kirlian photography.
Yes.
Of 45 years ago, they were able to show auras around trees and plants, and if they cut a leaf and took that leaf away, there would still be a little aura where that cut leaf was until after so many hours that energy field would actually dissipate. So we're getting close. It's like with infrared photography and ultraviolet photography, we as a humanity one day might be able to see very clearly the non-physical counterpart around trees, the so-called aura of all trees, and then we'll start to realize that we are surrounded in essentially subtle light given off by these living beings.
Interesting also here, Tim, I'll just toss something else in here. A few years ago when Barry Brailsford and Kush were here for a meal, I'd been demonstrating the little machine with the peace lily. I went out to the garden to gather plants for our tea, and I brought back kale and lettuce leaves and that. And then Barry said, why don't we try one of the leaves out of the garden, like the kale? So I thought, yeah, let's connect to the leaf, which we'd been connecting to the leaf on the growing plant. There was nothing came. Already the picking of that plant from the garden straight into the kitchen and putting it on the plant, there was nothing left. Not that I could detect in that form. I'd say at a cellular level, there'd still be light. But what we're measuring is the little bursts of static electricity which come from a growing plant, which is generated by the movement within each leaf and each stem of the sap and the waters. And they're opening and closing little valves, tiny valves inside each trunk and each leaf and each plant. This creates this little electricity burst. That's what we pick up. So just severing the leaf, bringing it inside, it would not create music because it just did not have that energy flow. Its heartbeat had stopped. Isn't that intriguing?
It is. It is, Gary, profound, eh? One snip and it's all over. Gary, we're out of time. We're out of time, and I'm so sorry.
Oh, we are.
Yes.
Yeah, we're well over time, so we have to go now. Yeah.
Very good. Okay, Gary, thank you.
That was my pleasure, Tim. Thank you so much for inviting me to share a few things. There's a lot more here that I can share, but that'll come in time. So thank you once again for making this time on your radio program available.
Excellent. Thank you again, and bye-bye. That was Gary Cook, and Elder, author, researcher, into the old ways and the ancient past of Aotearoa, New Zealand. He is also known as a Matua in Māori. And his website is secretland.co.nz. secretland.co.nz. Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send, and remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it. Spread it. Radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies, but of 7.6 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM, and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre. And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say Kia Kaha and Haere Rā.